Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, good evening, everyone. This is what the People's Medicine Show on Blog Talk Radio on the Susan Weed radio feed. My name's Sean. I'm a community herbalist. I'm based in upstate New York, and right now I'm planning to do a move. I'm going to live out on the western part of the United States. So, yeah, I've been packing up my things, and I was out doing my laundry tonight at the laundromat, and I looked up, and the moon is amazingly beautiful and kind and loving tonight. There's times when the moon seems to overstimulate me and make me crazy, but tonight's a good moon for some reason. So I don't know what else. I really have not prepared for this evening, so I said I wanted to speak more about ginkgo. So my adventures with ginkgo have been going on for a few years. I didn't even know how to identify the tree 3 or 4 years ago, and now it's one of the most easy trees to identify because the leaf of the tree is so distinct. There's no other tree with a leaf like ginkgo. As far as being able to identify trees from bark and looking at the bark pattern, there's some people who could do that so well, and I just seem to look at bark, and all the bark looks all the same to me. But perhaps in the future, I'm going to stay open-minded. Perhaps I'll become one of those people who could look at the bark of a tree and pretty much guess what it is by not even looking at the other characteristics of the way people identify what tree you're looking at, especially now that the winter's coming and all the leaves fall off the tree. I was told when I've taken some basic botany classes that the number one way and the most accurate way to identify a plant is by looking at the flower and the fruit, and you'll be able to really pinpoint exactly what plant you're dealing with is when you look at a flower, and that's how they classify plants is the design and all the parts of the flowers. And but let me keep going with ginkgo. So I gathered some ginkgo maybe 3 or 4 years ago, a real small amount. We were walking around in New York City, and I had no idea that it was mostly medicinal, or people consider it mostly medicinal when the leaves turn yellow. So I gathered a few of the green leaves a few years ago and stuck them in a jar with some 100 proof vodka, and I tinctured those, and it was a real small amount, maybe 2 ounces, maybe 3 ounces, I don't know. I haven't even drained that bottle, or strained those ginkgo leaves, the green ones that I tinctured a number of years ago. But I stuck my finger in it today and tasted it, because I'm packing and reducing the size of my herb collection and checking things out, and it tasted wonderful, the green-leafed ginkgo. And as compared to these ginkgo leaves that I harvested last year that were yellow, and which are way more bitter, way more of a difficult flavor, where it's interesting how the green leaves have a sweetness, a loveliness, and I was told, I'm still learning, so it's all, revealing itself to me. But someone told me that there are Canadian doctors that use ginkgo, and they have specific applications for the green ginkgo leaves as compared to the yellow ginkgo leaves. So I'm going to try to find out more about that. A friend of mine told me, heard it from another herbalist, so I really have to do more work about. And that little noise is a reminder from this app on my computer called Toggle, T-O-G-G-L. And it's like, it's telling me, don't forget to track your time. So I've been using this Toggle app. So when I'm I need to go in the kitchen and clean things up and straighten things up. So I'll hit the Toggle timer and say, I'm going to go in the kitchen and clean up the kitchen. And it's fascinating how then, I get tired of working in the kitchen, straightening out. And it's like I have about a 5 to 10 minute attention span on anything I do. But it's a wonderful awareness exercise, though, using this Toggle timer. But I have to somehow learn how to use it where it doesn't, when I'm not using it, that it's not always telling me, why aren't you using the Toggle timer? So as I started a 2-hour radio show, I know what I'm going to be doing in the next 2 hours. I'm going to be talking to you all, the audience. And if you click my link on the social media advertisement for the show, this is a call-in show, so I would love it if people call in. If you have anything to talk about, especially ginkgo biloba, I would love to get some phone calls. I did a recent work weekend with Susan Weed, and a number of people called her throughout the week saying, yeah, we're going to come on the week and do some work exchange, and I was the only one that seemed to have showed up. But and I was kind of busy this past weekend, so I was showing up just for 2 or 3 hours to and I did one of the most wonderful things that you'll do if you come to a work exchange weekend at the Wise Woman Center, and that is press cider. And what a great time. I've done this almost every year since 2010. I'll go visit Susan Weed on a weekend in October and November and press cider. And it's a really wonderful exercise. And it's like that cider, it lasts all throughout the winter. And I remember last year I took a gallon of it with me home, and I just kept it in my fridge and had a mouthful whenever I thought about it. And then as the winter goes on, it starts like fermenting. And so it'll go from like fizziness to like a booziness. And then it turns into sort of a vinegar by the end of the winter. But it's funny though, because I was in the mood for cider about a month ago, so I grabbed just the commercially prepared cider, and they put some kind of like potassium sorbate or something in it to keep it from turning like that. But there's just something so wonderful about the sugar that you'll get from apples. And so I think I am going to, when I take a little break from talking, I'm going to go pour myself some apple cider. And so I took home, since I'm going to be moving in the beginning of December, probably the second week of December, I took home a half a gallon of cider. So hopefully I'll just go through it and finish it. And but it is fun to always have that in my refrigerator. And this year there was a lot of yellow jackets that were all around us. And it's funny, yellow jackets very rarely sting people. I think you have to kind of like bump into one or squish it to get stung by a yellow jacket. But Susan Weed's cohort, Michael or Mickey, he got stung this weekend. And I didn't ask him the details. But I'm very happy I didn't get stung. But my half gallon of apple cider that was pressed this weekend has a yellow jacket in it. So it's blessed with don't call it a bee because it doesn't make honey. It's not a bee, but it looks like a bee, but it's not a bee. It's a yellow jacket. My apple cider that's in the fridge has a friendly little yellow jacket floating around in it, exuding goodness. But it's funny because every time I pour it out of it, the yellow jacket hasn't come, so it'll probably be in there probably till the end of the bottle. It's funny though, recently I've been just like really, I don't want to eat poop or dirt, or anything foul tasting, but really not concerned about things, you know. I went to a rock concert the other night in Port Chester, New York, and I can feel I'm in this crowded room with, you know, we're in very close quarters, and I could just feel my immune system just being bombarded with different people's germs and everything. And it was like, oh, I should have brought some elderberry. But when I got home, I got some elderberry, and I elderberry syrup is just an amazing herb to use, you know, like that, like when you've been getting bombarded with different people's germs, and you have a little elderberry. It has like an antiviral effect, or enhances your immune system in a way that you just really is very helpful if you're in cold and flu season. And yeah, so speaking of elderberry, I went through all these herb tinctures since I'm reducing my herb collection and trying to pack it all up and get it nice so it has you know, so it ships properly. So I went through all these herb tinctures that had eyedroppers, and every single one of them just married with a rubber flavor, and it was really very discouraging, you know, to be able to, you know, have to. I was told this years ago, you know, that Paul, oh, I can't remember his name, herbalist who lives in Ohio near the botanical sanctuary, Plant Savers, but he is a big believer in don't use rubber droppers, you know. So again, you know, so I had to learn the hard way, but so I lost a lot of nice herbs. I lost my barberry, and I lost some other herbs that were gifted to me from people. And so I know in the future to get one of those phenolic tops if I'm given a bottle of herb tincture, and you know, if I'm going to store herbs for a long period, longer than a week or two, you know, to remove the eyedropper, because also the herbs will evaporate through those eyedroppers. So herbal tinctures have years and years of shelf life. I just talked about some ginkgo tincture that I had that tastes as fresh as the first time I've tasted it, and but it's not stored in a bottle with an eyedropper on top. So another heads up to you all, you know, if you're just beginning out making herb tinctures for yourself, to be careful with those eyedropper bottles. They're really convenient. They're an optimum way if you're going to measure and be precise in how you want to use the herb tinctures. There's a lot of herb tinctures like poke and even osha. You know, you want to count the drops for certain herbs. A lot of the herbs that I use, I just pretty much eyeball it, you know. Even on Motherwort, which many people can have just five or six drops on. But then I just use a lot of herbs, just really entire, you know. I think Motherwort, though, I would probably use a quarter of an eyedropper, maybe a half an eyedropper. And if I'm like anxious and feeling a little overstimulated, Motherwort can really bring me back down to a grounded feeling. But I've been using a lot less Motherwort. I've spoken about this. I was using it quite a bit, so I was wildcrafting large amounts of it. And then about a year or two ago, I started using Rhodiola rosea, once in the morning, once in the afternoon, and then this evening overstimulated feeling just it stopped happening. And now I would say stopped happening. I would say it comes back maybe once or twice a month instead of you know, it, you know, coming upon me and just being consecutive days in a row, you know. So again, Rhodiola rosea has, you know, given me some kind of benefit where I'm able to deal with stress in a way that I wasn't dealing with stress, where I was really burnt out by the end of the day, where yeah, I would call the feeling frazzled. And recently someone told me, you be careful the way you make that silly toggle timer. Don't forget to track your time. So a lot of these things, though, these convenient apps, boy, they really, I guess I'm going to open up the preferences now and say, idle detection. Okay, I'm going to uncheck detection. So it was set up where if I was idle for 5 minutes and not timing my activities, it would jump up and say, are you timing yourself? So maybe I'll reactivate that again because I am going to be busy and doing a lot of work in my home. So maybe I'll reactivate the thing with the toggle timer. But I've gone most of my life without having a system, you know, to be productive. So I'm forgiving myself that, you know, I've worked without a net. I'm working without a net right now, like really not having a full outline of what I want to talk about tonight. So I pulled out a few herbal books and I'm going to take a break from talking for a while. And I'll come back and hopefully I'll be able to read a little something about ginkgo. So I've been looking around in many of the books. I had this book on tree medicine. There was very little about ginkgo. So I donated that book on tree medicine because I was like, it's really weak. That it didn't, you know, I think maybe that's the reason I even bought the book. I was like, oh, that would be a book that would talk all about ginkgo and I don't think there was anything in it. I'm going to take a little bit of a break. And perhaps if you're listening to this as a recording, it won't be that long of a break because I think when I hit mute on the dashboard, it stops the recording. So it may not be that long. If you're listening live, it may be up to 10 minutes that I'm going to take a break. So hang in there and I'm going to be back soon. Bye-bye. Okay, welcome back to the People's Medicine Show. I'm the host, Sean Mernon. So I was looking around at some books to read, and I am going to read more from Dr. James A. Duke, PhD. He's a botanist, a very famous person who, he's great. You just have to Google his name and you'll find out all about him. I visited a botanical garden that he started, and he put a medicinal garden in Peru, and it was one of Dr. Duke's gardens that he planted out in Peru with little labels of all the medicinal plants. But I wanted to read something about ginkgo, and sure enough, Dr. Duke's book, The Green Pharmacy, has a few mentions of ginkgo. I'm going to go ahead and read his entire section that he wrote on stroke. He has a section of the book called Choosing the Herbs That Heal, and he has, just a bunch of different conditions, and he writes about a condition. So I'm going to read the section he wrote on stroke. I was reading it while I was on pause, and I was like, wow, this is great. So let's go for it. All right, I'll begin. Here's a quote from one of the thousands of letters I have received over the years, written by people disillusioned enough with their physicians to seek an alternative. My husband, age 57, suffered a stroke a year ago. The doctors believe he still has a blood clot somewhere in his brain, though they can't seem to dissolve it. He's currently taking many, many drugs, but they don't seem to be doing much to help him. Can you suggest any herbal he might take? That's the usual loaded question, the one that usually prompts me to remind everyone that I'm a botanist, not a doctor. Strokes are very serious, the nation's third leading cause of death. And anyone who has had one should certainly be under a physician's care and follow their doctor's advice. With that said, however, there are indeed quite a few herbal approaches to preventing stroke and stroke reoccurrence, at least the type caused by blood clots in the brain, ischemic strokes. Brain attack. Approximately 500,000 Americans have strokes annually. 80% of these strokes are ischemic. A blood clot lodges in a brain artery, cutting off the supply of oxygen and nourishment to part of that essential organ. Wherever the blood clot forms, the area around it dies or becomes damaged, and the body function controlled by that area becomes impaired. While such a stroke often causes death, it might lead instead to a severe disability, such as loss of the ability to speak or paralysis of part of the body. Ischemic strokes are often preceded by mini strokes known as transient ischemic attacks, TIAs. TIAs last anywhere from a few seconds to several hours and can cause stroke symptoms that eventually resolve on their own. Those who suffer TIAs typically make full or almost full recoveries. But TIAs indicate a real risk of future catastrophic stroke and often signal the start of aggressive preventative treatment. The other 20% of strokes are hemorrhagic. In this kind of stroke, a cerebral blood vessel bursts, and the result is the same as an ischemic stroke, impairment of the part of the body that the damaged area controls. Whether you're talking about mainstream or herbal medicine, stroke prevention and treatment are tricky because many of the approaches that help prevent ischemic stroke may actually increase the risk of the less common but equally disabling or deadly hemorrhagic stroke. To prevent the more common ischemic stroke, physicians try to prevent arterial blood clots by prescribing anticoagulant blood thinning medication. But when that is done, the risk increases that any bleeding in the brain won't stop, thus increasing the risk of a hemorrhagic stroke. So stroke prevention involves a complicated balancing act. Green pharmacy for stroke. Because the vast majority of strokes are ischemic, most of the suggestions in this chapter relate to preventing cerebral blood clotting. But I reiterate that hemorrhagic strokes are also a possibility, especially for those with a personal or family history of hemorrhagic stroke or aneurysm, a dangerously dilated blood vessel. If you have high blood pressure, which is the major risk factor for stroke, see a doctor and have it treated. You can also enlist the help of an herbal alternative suggested in the chapter on high blood pressure on page 254. Please remember, it's important to follow any stroke preventative medical advice that comes from your doctor. In fact, if you've had a stroke or know that you are at risk, it would be a really good idea to discuss any stroke preventing herbs that you'd like to try with your doctor. That said, here are a number of good herbal approaches to stroke prevention and treatment you should be aware of. Garlic, Allium sativum. Garlic is the best anti-clotting herb. According to my database, it contains more anticoagulant compounds than any other herb, 9 to be exact. It is a major herb for heart attack prevention because of its blood thinning effect and its ability to help control high blood pressure. The same effects also prevent ischemic stroke. If I were at risk for stroke, I'd increase my use of garlic in cooking and also take garlic capsules, which are available at health food stores and many drug stores. Garlic's close relatives, onions, scallions, leeks, chives, and shallots, have similar benefits. On the other hand, if I had reason to be concerned about hemorrhagic stroke, I'd steer clear of garlic and its other anti-clotting herbal relatives. If you're not absolutely sure which category you fall into, ask your doctor to help you make this decision. Ginkgo biloba. Ginkgo is widely used in Europe to treat complications of stroke, including memory and balance problems, vertigo, and disturbed thought processes. Many studies show that this herb increases blood flow to the brain. Varro Tyler, PhD, Dean and Professor Emeritus of Pharmacognosy, Natural Product Pharmacy at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, endorses this herb as a stroke treatment in his excellent book, Herbs of Choice. Ginkgo also helps reduced fragility of the capillaries, the tiny blood vessels that fan throughout your body, which can help prevent hemorrhagic stroke. In Europe, many elderly people take ginkgo regularly. I wouldn't be surprised if this herb doesn't soon become increasingly popular with elderly folks in the United States as well. To take this herb, you'll need to buy a standardized extract. Ginkgo extracts are widely available at health food stores and drug stores. You can try 60 to 240 milligrams a day, but don't go any higher than that. In large amounts, ginkgo may cause diarrhea, irritability, and restlessness. And here's a little cutaway reading from the stroke section. Are you interested in a surefire method for preventing stroke? A report published in the Journal of American Medical Association suggests that stroke risk might be reduced 22% simply by eating more than 3 servings of fresh fruits and vegetables a day. So that's more than 3 servings of fresh fruits and vegetables a day. You should be eating at least that much anyway, since the National Cancer Institute recommends at least 5 servings a day to help prevent cancer. And if you follow those guidelines, you're helping to ward off 2 major threats, since fruits and vegetables contain many vitamins and minerals that are helpful in preventing stroke. One British study, for example, suggested that eating the amount of vitamin C in just half an orange, somewhere between 100 and 300 milligrams, every day significantly decreased the incidence of stroke. Pigweed. So let's go back to the plants. Pigweed, amaranthus, various species, and other foods containing calcium. A 6-year Harvard study of more than 40,000 health professionals showed that compared with those who consumed the least calcium, those who got the most had just 1/3 the risk of succumbing to heart attack. Personally, I believe these results also apply to ischemic strokes because they are biologically so similar to heart attack. Pigweed is an excellent plant source of calcium with 5.3% on a dry weight basis. According to my calculations, about 1/3 of an ounce of fresh pigweed leaves would provide 500 milligrams of calcium. The daily value is 1,000 milligrams. You can use the young leaves in salads or steam the more mature leaves like spinach. You might also try pigweed pesto. To make the sauce, prepare your favorite pesto recipe, pigweed instead of basil. Pigweed is not only one good herbal source of calcium. Here are some others in descending order of potency on a dry weight basis. Lamb's quarters, stinging nettle, broad beans, watercress, licorice, marjoram, savory, red clover shoots, thyme, Chinese cabbage, bok choy, basil, celery seed, dandelion, and purslane. Yum. Okay, the next section is on willow for stroke prevention and perhaps stroke treatment. Willow, salix, various species. Willow bark is an herbal aspirin, and low-dose aspirin, half of a standard tablet to a whole tablet a day, has been shown in several studies to reduce the risk of ischemic stroke by 18%. Low-dose aspirin also cuts heart attack risk by about 40% in men and 25% in women. You can take the little white aspirin pills if you like. I personally prefer the herbal route. Teas made from willow bark, meadow sweet, or wintergreen. I add a teaspoon or two of any of these dry herbs to either hot herbal teas or cold lemonade and drink 2 to 3 cups a day. I must confess, though, that I tend to be lazy and often take my own low-dose aspirin in pills. Again, willow bark and the other aspirin-like herbs should only be used to prevent and treat ischemic stroke. They are powerfully anticoagulant and may increase the risk of hemorrhage, including hemorrhagic stroke. In fact, the Physician's Health Study, the large scientific study that showed aspirin's abilities to prevent heart attack, showed a slight increase in risk of hemorrhagic stroke from taking aspirin daily. The increase was small and not statistically significant, but if you're at risk for this type of stroke, consult your doctor before taking aspirin or any aspirin-like herbs. You probably also should avoid them if you're allergic to aspirin. Carrot, Dorcas carota. In a Harvard study of 87,245 female nurses, consumption of carrots, and to a lesser extent spinach, significantly reduced stroke risk. Women who ate 5 servings of carrots a week suffered 68% fewer strokes than those who ate carrots less than twice a month. Carrots are rich in beta-carotene and other carotenoids, all members of the vitamin A family. Other studies show that people can reduce the risk of stroke by as much as 54% if they eat lots of fruits and veggies that are rich in beta-carotene and vitamin C and E. The message is clear. Eat more carrots. I munch them as snacks, include them in my vegetable soups, and juice them too, sometimes with garlic. English pea, Pisum sativum. Pisum sativum? It turns out that nearly all legumes contain genistein, which appear to be a cancer preventative nutrient. Scientists now believe that a diet high in genistein rich tofu, soy product, is an important reason that Asian women have such a low rate of breast cancer. In addition to guarding against cancer, genistein also appears to have significant anti-clotting effect, meaning that it may also prevent ischemic stroke and heart attack. I like English peas more than I like soybeans, so this is relatively new information, was welcome news to me. I also eat lots of other beans and legumes, and I suggest that you do too. Pineapple, Ananas camosensis. Pineapple contains a compound known as bromelain that is best known for its ability to break down proteins. It's a key ingredient in meat tenderizers, but bromelain also has anti-clotting action that may help prevent ischemic stroke and heart attack. The bottom line, eat more fresh pineapple. Scurfy pea, Soralia corifolia. These peas contain genistein. After 4 long years of searching and researching, I finally have data to show that scurfy peas, consumed as a food and reputed to be an aphrodisiac in Asia, contain much more genistein than soybeans. I think my colleague Peter Kaufman, PhD, at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, for helping me to determine the genistein content of scurfy peas. Bilberry, Vaccinium myrtillus. Bilberries are, and their close relatives, blueberries and huckleberries, contain compounds known as anthocyanidins. Good European studies show that those compounds help prevent blood clots and also help break down plaque deposits lining the arteries. In addition, some evidence suggests that bilberries help maintain capillaries. For all of these reasons, bilberries and their relatives might help prevent ischemic stroke without increasing the risk of hemorrhagic stroke. Medical anthropologist John Heinemann, PhD, author of Heinemann's Encyclopedia of Fruits, Vegetables, and Herbs, says that 1 glass of huckleberry juice taken twice a week can help prevent stroke. I'm not as convinced as he seems to be, but these berries are delicious, and if they do help prevent stroke, so much the better. Here's a little cutaway about scurfy pea. Scurfy peas have a high concentration of a compound that may help protect a woman's body from harmful estrogens. All right, let's move along. Evening primrose. The oil of this herb is rich in gamma-linolenic acid, GLA, which has a potent anti-clotting and blood pressure-lowering actions. I think it's probably quite useful in the prevention of stroke and heart disease. Borage oil is also rich in GLA. You can purchase both of these oils as health food at health food stores. To use them, follow the package directions. Ginger, Zingiber officinale. This is another herb with proven anti-clotting ability. In one Indian study, taking about 2 teaspoons of ginger a day for a week neutralized the blood clotting effect of 100 grams of butter. But please don't think you can continue to eat butter if you up your ginger intake. Butter is very high in cholesterol, which contributes to strokes. Okay, Mr. Duke, maybe let's see what the – we'll stop reading here. Is Mr. Duke is telling us – all right, so this is 1997, and they were telling us that butter is high in cholesterol, which contributes to strokes. So that is very doesn't seem to be the word today. Right now, the word today is eat butter in, I think they would say, a moderate amount. Maybe 100 grams of butter, though, a week. That might be a little bit too much. But I'm going to just continue reading, but I wanted to stop because that doesn't seem to – that's 1997 information that he's telling us. So ginger. Let's continue to read about ginger. You might try using more ginger in cooking, or you could brew ginger tea using 1 or 2 teaspoons of fresh grated root per cup of boiling water until cool. Spinach, Spinacea oleracea, and other foods containing folate. A good deal of evidence shows that nutritional approaches can help prevent stroke. Studies at Tufts University in Boston and the University of Alabama in Birmingham, for example, have demonstrated that folate can help prevent both heart disease and stroke. Compared with people who consume little folate, those who ingested the most were only half as likely to show narrowing of the carotid artery, the artery that leads to the brain. Folate is not plentiful in plants, huh? But according to my database, huh? Spinach, cabbage, endive, asparagus, parsley, okra, and pigweed all have this important nutrient. So the more of these veggies you get in your diet, the better. I think it is plentiful in plants, but we'll move on. Turmeric, curcuma ionica. Many studies show that the compound curcumin, which is found in this herb, helps prevent the formation of blood clots. Turmeric is a key ingredient in most curry spice blends. You might consider eating more curry dishes or even making your own turmeric capsules. Many health food stores sell empty gelatin capsules. Okay. So, yeah. So, butter, high-fat butter, high cholesterol, it contributes to strokes. So, I think, I think butter's got a bad rap because the American diet was increased in hydrogenated vegetable oils, and I don't think any kind of amount of ginger or turmeric will help you eat more hydrogenated vegetable oils, and so I think. Yeah, it's really fascinating, though, that 1997 that many people were still saying that if you have a high butter diet, that you're going to get a heart attack and stroke, where it appears that the nutritional things that are causing, like really destructive foods that you could put in your body are these hydrogenated vegetable oils. And so I'd like to tell you one of my favorite foods to eat is whole milk yogurt. And one of my favorite ways to make it is I'll make like a yogurt sauce to put on food. So I'll put like maybe a half a cup of yogurt, maybe a three quarters cup of yogurt in a saucepan. And then I'll put like a full heaping teaspoon of turmeric, and then maybe a half the amount. So like a 2-to-1 amount of powdered turmeric to powdered ginger. And then I also use granulated garlic and a little parsley. That's my one of my favorite sauces that I use. I try to use it more than once a week, a yogurt curry sauce. So that's my curry, granulated garlic and 2-to-1 with turmeric and ginger. And we'll see. One of these days, I'm going to get one of these calcium scan tests, and you're able to tell the parts of your body that have narrow arteries. I'm still finding out a little bit about that. From what I understand, it's a pretty non-invasive test, and you're able to tell if you have narrowing of the arteries or if you – and there's actually like a number. And many people are zero. They have zero hardened, narrowed arteries according to this test. I think it's called a calcium score. So in future shows, I've plan to do more research about this, but I heard it on Vinny Tortelloni's nutrition podcast, and so I'm going to do a little bit more work on that. So it looks like we got an hour and 10 minutes left of the show, and I'm going to take it a little break, and maybe I'll come back and I'll read some Juliette de Barak Levy books. So I'll be back probably in 5 minutes, and hopefully the people who are listening to the recording, it won't be 5 minutes. It'll be a shorter pause. So, bye-bye. Be back soon.
We talked about,
BPD?
Yeah.
Okay, so, yeah, I got a... I went to, like, rehab in, like, December.
Yeah, this is Sean. I was looking at my audio clips, and that was my clip from last month, the borderline personality disorder. So if you're interested in that show, that was last month's show. So I'll be back soon. Okay, so I selected what I'm going to read from Juliette de Barak Levy tonight, and I think I'm going to read the entire first chapter of her book, A Gypsy in New York, which is a travel book of her visiting New York, and I believe it has a original copyright date of 1962. And before I get back into reading Juliette, I want to stay faithful. I announced that I was going to put the pros and cons of using soft foam rollers tonight. It's one of the topics I was discussing. And I was listening to the Tim Ferriss podcast last month, and he had an episode called Tips and Tricks for Better Sleep, and he had a number of, his guests give their ideas about things, and this one guest was answering a bunch of questions, and someone asked him about foam rollers, and he was like, yeah, I'm totally against them because people spin their wheels using these things where they can use something better. It just popped out at me, and it stuck with me because I didn't realize that some people really are, they're in a lot of pain and they're trying to, that they're not going to get relief from their pain, according to this gentleman, and they better off going to a soft tissue person to work on pain. But I've been using a foam roller for about 2 years now, and I'll bring it with me. And I use a specific one, and I'm very grateful that I was introduced to foam rolling the way I was, because I was told that a lot of people use these hard foam rollers. And I was looking at YouTube today, and yeah, it seems like most people are using these really hard foam rollers, and it's like they're extremely painful to use these things. And I was introduced to foam rolling at a class at the yoga school that I go to. It was just an extra class, and it was called Myofascial Release. And it was taught by a gentleman named Terrence Pfister, and he's a yoga teacher here in Kingston, New York. And he learned about it from Sue Hitzman, who has the MELT method. So he's sort of, you know, it's a derivative of Sue Hitzman's MELT method, and then my version of using the foam roller is a derivative of Derek Fisher's method. So I begin my workout by laying on the foam roller lengthwise. I don't roll like, you know, a rolling pin, you know, on it. I just lay on it, and then I just go, you know, rotate side to side. So I hope to do some YouTube videos, because I was on YouTube today looking for, you know, people doing it the way I do it, and I did not see one single workout where they said, yeah, begin like this, you know, ground yourself in this way. And I just wanted to, you know, thank Terrence, you know, for showing me this. And I think it was, you know, he was, you know, it was about a $25 class, and it was 2 hours, and it's, you know, changed my life. That I tend to get, you know, tension build up in my back, and I have this wonderful tool that is a lot faster than a 45-minute yoga session, like 5 or 10 minutes of using a foam roller. Just totally changes my entire, you know, my entire day. It's just like, okay, let's start the day over without any tension in my body. So I hope to be able to do some foam roller videos. But it was interesting looking around on YouTube today and how people do try to, like, use it on their lower back and their lower ribs, and they can end up hurting themselves. And so I would, you know, even though I'm a person that says, oh, try foam rolling, you may be going down the wrong road with that thing. And I hope, you know, this gentle, you know, real nice way of using a foam roller, because I've seen people really do some stuff with it that may not be safe. So please use your intuitiveness, work with an expert. You know, an expert taught me how to do it. So perhaps really, you know, use your discretion and intuition. And if you want to try to relieve stress or, you know, because I get these tension knots, boy, and they turn into pain very quickly. And I'm very happy that, you know, I used it. And I'll go ahead and mention the actual brand, because I've tried all these different foam rollers, and none of them are, they're all like very painful and hard and mean, you know. And I use one from a company called OPTP, and it's called, let me look at it. It's called Pro-Roller Soft. So they do make a firmer one. But even their firmer one, that's the Pro Roller from OPTP. And so even their, like, medium firm one, you know, that's not the soft, is still a lot less horrible than some of these other ones that I see people using. And they have, like, these spikes, and oh, my goodness. And it really, you know, I'm very happy that I've crossed paths with people who, you know, go gentle. You know, if something hurts, first of all, I would never have stuck with something that hurt. So it feels good to have developed sort of some systems in my life that have helped me a lot. And that's why I'm doing this show, to be able to spread what I found. And, you know, I am kind of a firm believer is, you know, when you get something, you can't really keep it unless you continue to give it away, you know. I think it'll slip away from people if they don't try to teach it to others. It's part of the practice of doing these healing and positive things is, you know, sharing it with others. So this little clip that I wanted to play tonight that sparked my interest in, oh, yeah, there might be a wrong way to use a foam roller, and maybe I should be careful when I say, oh, I'm an advocate of foam rolling. Because my version of foam rolling is not like anything I've seen on YouTube. You know, these people are, like, really into that. No pain, no gain, you know. And that's not necessarily the case, you know, when it comes to exercising. You know, you really want to prevent injury and heal from injuries, not cause injuries. So I do believe also in using a soft tissue person. If you're messed up and out of alignment, you know, try to, you know, investigate using people who, because I had a sciatica pain earlier this year, and I thought, well, let me try a chiropractor treatment. And the chiropractor is like, you do not need chiropractor treatment. You need some soft tissue work. And that was very amazing, you know, that I found the right people at the right time. And I hope other people can, you know, be as lucky as me. And I don't know if I use the word luck, right? But so here is something. So when I first heard it, you know, this guy saying, oh, people are wasting their time with foam rolling. But then when I really listened to him, I'm like, yeah, he's got something there. So I wanted to play this, and it's, I think it was the first expert on the Tips and Tricks episode of the Tim Ferriss podcast. So I'm going to go ahead and play this.
The next question is from Roddy Leap, and he asked me, you're not a big fan of foam rolling, isn't foam rolling a massage? Thing, my beef against foam rolling is that it would be trying to build a bridge one pebble at a time. It takes far too long. So there's such a thing as the principle of training economy. I mean, Tim is big on that, whether you eat a four-hour body or any of his books. It's like you have to have maximum return least amount of time. So people waste tremendous amount of time foam rolling. The amount of time they waste on foam rolling could be trying to get flexible, could be done in a good 20-minute active release session or Rolfing technique or the Voila method. There's a lot of stuff out there that exists to get rid of adhesions and improve range of motion. So, and let's say if you have a good active release practitioner and you're foam rolling because you have a tight shoulder, if the guy does a good job, and let's say you're the worst case scenario, you're about as flexible as a crowbar, within 5 treatments, you'll have 100% range of motion. And if you're a complete certified idiot, you will still maintain those gains for 6 weeks. So that's 6 months, I'm sorry. So in my opinion, to go see a very good soft tissue practitioner and invest the time and money into that will save you all these countless hours of foam rolling, because you will have the results and it'll be more permanent.
Okay, yeah, so hopefully that made a full circle around. And I'm really looking forward to being able to share the healing that I've gotten from getting some soft tissue work done and doing regularly, you know, 5 or 10 minutes here and there throughout the week of some foam rolling. And it really gives me instant results. But maybe I'm at the place where I don't have real big adhesions that need really to be worked on, you know, and just maybe you're up to that fifth river of healing where you need to really stimulate, you know, and get something going on in that part of your body to, you know, knock it all back into track. So these are all just healing things that I've experienced, and I want to share it with other people. I wish other people would call in with their experiences of getting soft tissue work done and really having a problem go away for good, you know, and then through practice and, you know, see, because I think generally I drove cross country, so it was basically a repetitive injury that I had that I was using, you know, I was driving a car for too long. So I got a repetitive injury. It caused like a big time, and it wasn't going to go away with my foam roller. I went and got myself some soft tissue work done. And yeah, so I guess this gentleman, the clip I played, you know, he was saying, yeah, people are just spinning their wheels. Just go get some soft tissue work done. And I mean, it was like one or two, it might have been 3 sessions that I paid for, and it was pretty affordable. And, you know, I would hate it, you know, if other people are like, yeah, let me just use pain medicine, you know, and let's not, you know, let's just try to fix it. And so I'm back to doing yoga once a week, and I actually showed up to yoga this week and the place was closed. So I was like, well, I showed up and that's my intention. Well, I'm going to take another little short break, and then I'm going to come back and begin reading, and that'll be the rest of the content for the show. I'm going to read an excerpt from A Gypsy in New York. I'm actually going to read the whole first chapter, and perhaps that'll be enough time to fill up the time, and I'm really having fun trying to think of things and be spot on with the time. But if I keep talking and don't take my break, I won't have enough time to finish the reading I want to do. So I'll take one more break. Okay, I'm back with the last section of the show, and I'm going to read chapter one from A Gypsy in New York by Juliet de Barakley Levy. And its original copyright, I believe, is 1962, and it's been revised and updated since then. Chapter one, New York and Manhattan. Like gypsies, we entered the port of New York in its wintertime, its bleak time. We came with the Atlantic winds, icy breaths, and burdened with snow. And with the winds rising off the great Hudson River, so broad and deep, whose tides flow at 150 miles an hour, to join at Albany, a system of canals which linked New York City with the Great Western Lakes and the St. Lawrence River. I liked the feel of the water and the winds around and within New York, and knowing from what places such winds and water came thither, I wondered if sometimes there might drop onto those man-made confined city streets a plume from a wild goose or a wild turkey in flight over the over that shut-in sky. Federico Garcia is one of my favorite people, both as a person and poet. When he stayed a while in New York, he was inspired to write of its dawn, La Aurora, that beautiful word as he saw it. New York's daybreak contains four columns of mire and a hurricane of black doves paddling in putrescent waters. I saw New York's daybreak differently. I saw gray mists clearing and leaving below valleys of yellowness, like the stretches of white daffodils, which I remember with longing from my childhood in England. So, New York, over those misty stretches of yellowness at dawn, fly crowd. Okay, let's try it again. I got to read this better. So, New York, over those misty stretches of yellowness at dawn, fly crowds of pigeons or doves. Call them either what you choose. Those birds seem as many and as noisy as honeybees emerging from an overturned beeskep, a hive made of straw. The New York pigeons are away in search of that day's food. Some receive stale bread or crumbs from compassionate New Yorkers. Others fend for themselves amongst garbage. They are clean-natured eaters of cereals only and decline all other food. Winter is the season when many gypsies move into their houses in cities all over the world, and they come likewise into New York. The gypsies are wanting house roofs over their heads during the cold winter months, and above all, opportunity to find well-paid work to enable them to amass the wherewithal to travel again, carefree, when the first scents of spring come on the warming air, as the Scottish tinkers say, when the yellow is on the broom bushes. A Chinese poet says of that time, how fragrant the scent that comes softly with the wind, breaking the traveler's heart in vain, as he halts his horse, wondering, wandering. The gypsy's hearts do not break, the gypsies go. Now, for American gypsies, Cadillac cars and upholstered trailers replace the horse-drawn carved wooden vans of former days. They follow old and new trails across America's, of north and south. In Mexico, I was to meet later. American-born gypsies from New York, mostly traveling in tropical Colima, with its great volcano dominating the beautiful part of the world. Many of the gypsies in Mexico made their money from sideshows, rather of the Punch and Judy type. As for wandering, I had arrived in New York from southern Spain with my 8-year-old son, Rafik Nisam, my 7-year-old daughter, Luz España, and an Afghan hound bitch, Singane. The dog was the greyhound kind, which the gypsies always like to keep, though in this case she was an Afghani greyhound breed, not one of the usual hair-chasing long tails of the gypsy world. In Spain, we had stayed in the absolute solitude of the hills of the Malaga territory on a goat farm, 2 hours donkey ride away from any village, where the only loud sounds were the pouring of swift streams down rocky courses and the hundredfold tambourines of shaking goat bells. Gypsies, equaled only by the nomad Bedouin Arabs, know and love the lonely places of the world. In Spain, there are mountain trails which only the gypsy caravans travel. The contrast of clamorous New York to the quiet of the Malaga Hills was extraordinary, but it was also exciting. I have heard many times from traveler friends, people who have lived and worked in many cities, especially writers and artists, that they consider New York to be the most exciting city in the world. I heard one woman passenger on the American Exports ship on which we entered the port of New York telling a woman passenger friend in her foreign-sounding English that if you live in New York, no need to go other place. New York got everything. I had visited New York 14 years ago. Then I had come by plane and had been wearing Paris-bought clothes and carried a mere handful of lightweight luggage. Now I had two young children at my side, and all three of us were wearing the sort of odd-looking clothes that longtime travelers tend to wear. Rough, hard-wearing materials, wide sleeves for comfort, and many big pockets to help carry things. I knew that my face had become as weather-worn as that of any old gypsy woman, although by age I should be considered young. But the heat and the winds of deserts, the cold of mountaintops, and the harsh weather of other places where true gypsy travel takes one, marks the face of travelers, as surely as it roughens the stones exposed to the year-round. Not all the lovely herbal lotions that one may make from flowers and leaves, steeped in sunlight and moonlight, can fully protect the skin against changing weather and changing climates. Also, like gypsies, I now carried all my possessions with me. As for years, I had had no home in which to leave things. So we brought into New York a burdensome weight of my children's collection of toys of the world, to which they were going to add later from New York's fabulous toy shops and the toy shop of the United Nations and all their books, the school ones from which I, with much labor, taught them, and their pleasure ones, also my own chosen books. And then all the weighty necessities of my two professions, herbalist and writer, including sacks of herbs which I had gathered and dried myself in many countries and used constantly, volumes of notes for books on herbs, human and veterinary, and notes on our travel. I intended to write these books one day, but meanwhile carried them from country to country, still unwritten. And then cameras and artist materials, and a heavy collection of ancient stones and pots, which my children and I had dug out of their hiding places in Europe, Mexico, and Israel. Some had gone into museums, others we could not bear to part with. Our luggage was now a collection of big wicker traveling basket trunks made by gypsies from such places as Poland and Spain, and also made from that lovely island of Madeira, rightly famed for its baskets. There was reason in such choice of luggage. The gypsies store their possession in sacks from the same motives. When clothing has to remain packed for months, it needs ventilation to prevent mustiness and discoloration. In the primitive places where we have stayed, from gypsy tents to old water mills and even ruins, our trunks are usually our only furniture, both for storing things and for sitting on. As I write this, we are living far from New York in an old Greek church by the Sea of Galilee in Israel. Our cell-like room is furnished with two beds and one table only. Therefore, our luggage is used for storage and for seating. And we will probably be living in this room for 3 months. The sky of New York held my attention. In winter, it seems to be a very high sky. Artists have commented on this. Its color, when the sun is not shining, is usually ashen, and against the pale color, the famous heaven-reaching, fantastic, often monolithic buildings of Manhattan look darkly gray. because Manhattan is such a narrow stretch of land, it is described as not as being not unlike a fish in shape. The New York builders, once they had built on every possible inch of the limited ground space, and still the demand for offices and apartments increased, had to build upwards toward the clouds. Thus, their descriptive name, skyscrapers. All who come to New York and look upon its crowding buildings, more pressed together and far more towering than any buildings anywhere else on earth, cannot help but to think back to the time when only a few hundred years ago, the only dwellings on that now crowded area of Manhattan were a few scattered lodges of the peaceful Canarsie Indians. It was said to have been a place of wild roses and brambles, which yielded wonderful blackberries. Perhaps it was the fragrance of those Manhattan wild roses which made the Indians name that land, which the surrounding rivers make an island, Manhattan, which means in their beautiful language, heavenly land. The official flower of New York State, aptly, is the wild rose. As a botanist, I know that two wild American plants are named after New York, the New York aster and the New York fern. The state has flower festivals. Every year, an apple blossom festival is held at Rochester, and later a lilac festival elsewhere. New York State's motto is equally apt, Excelsior, ever upward. Looking around at the Manhattan skyline reaching its climax in the Empire State Building, which pierces the sky like a giant hypodermic syringe, one wonders if the motto was chosen with Manhattan in mind. Now, the roses and blackberry bushes are found only in the parks, and there is no heavenly fragrance. Nostril-pricking fumes of petrol from the exhaust pipes of vehicles of every kind, which teem in every street in the city, belching fumes from the numerous factories which surround New York City and poison the city's heart, all afflict one's nose and lungs. Like the gypsy, I am always conscious of the poisoned air of cities throughout my time in New York and later in Los Angeles, where I suffered worst of all. The waterfront of New York, stretching as far as one's eyes can see ahead, seems enormous, and there are indeed about 700 miles of it. Many nostalgic seamen songs have been written about it. It faces numerous small islands, the most famous and romantic of these islands being that on which stands the Liberty Statue. All ships' passengers approaching New York keep a lookout for the towering Statue of Liberty. That splendid woman of copper standing on a small, water-splashed piece of land in New York Harbor. Sea mists and salty winds blown inland from the Atlantic have grayed and greened the copper figure and made her more beautiful. She is a perching place for seagulls and other seabirds, and sometimes, oh, wonderful wild geese. Although she is of Amazon type and her face is stern, for she must protect her torch of liberty from being blown out by any oppressing forces. The words inscribed at her feet are tender enough. I know that they had been composed for the statue by a young Jewish woman, Emma Lazarus. My father, when I was a girl, had once given me a small volume of her poems. I had been impressed then by the promise of the Golden Door. But I have ceased to look for the golden doors into anywhere, for I have come to believe that life is really more fun on the other side among the ragged bohemians. I wanted to know the complete words of the inscribed verse on the Statue of Liberty as our ship sailed past. I wanted to tell them to my children as they stood at my side marveling at New York Harbor. Therefore, it was strange to me that of the 12 Americans around me on the ship whom I asked, One of them a schoolmistress, and most of them New Yorkers, not one of them could tell me the words. Here they are, beautiful in their promise to all homeless wanderers, from the New Colossus by Emma Lazarus. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. The immense statue is presented by France to America. In admiration and friendship, symbolic of the liberty and freedom enjoyed by all citizens of America under a free government, elected freely by the people, for the people, a symbol of liberty enlightening the world. Nowadays, the wretched human refuse find America a difficult country to enter. The official question forms to be completed and the guarantees to be made would baffle most modern wandering gypsies wishing to enter as immigrants. My children and I only came as visitors to America, and that was difficult enough. Then on arrival, there was talk of detaining us on Ellis Island because of my absolute refusal to have my children and dog vaccinated. As an herbalist, I keep my children and animals, dogs and goats, all safe and healthy on the medicines of the Bible, the herbs and the grasses. I fear no disease, and so far, with the exception of typhus in Spain years ago, I have not had to pay 1 cent to any doctor other than for an occasional certificate of good health needed as we travel from country to country. Herbal medicine is also Native American medicine, well known to those who occupied the New York State region before the coming of the Dutch, the great peaceful nations of the Iroquois Confederacy. These farmers, hunters, and fishermen were some of the largest and most powerful of the North American Indian nations. Close to the island of the Statue of Liberty is Ellis Island, the gateway into New York, that is also detention and deportation center of the United States Immigration Service. For 2 centuries, New York itself has been an El Dorado to pressing crowds of immigrants and exiles from Europe. And among those human masses, many thousands of Serbian and Balkan gypsies entered at the time of World War I. The Jewish population of New York City is enormous, at times as high as 30% of the population. And then now it says in 2002, it was 12% were Jewish. In the Lower East Side, thousands of Jews occupy whole streets, but there is no ghetto there or anywhere in America. The American Jewish people are a free and prosperous minority, and their genius has created many of New York's most famous and most beautiful stores. Christopher Columbus's voyage to the New World was supposed to have been financed largely by Portuguese Jews. At the time of Columbus's voyage, King Ferdinand had already turned his jealous eyes upon the flourishing Jews of Spain, and the Spanish and the Portuguese Jews anxiously hoped that the great navigator, perhaps of their own race, as some historians had decided, would find them a new country to which they could flee from the commencing agony of the Spanish Inquisition. And that was exactly what came to be. Although not as refugees from the Spanish persecutors, that was too early. The Jews of Spain leaving then for Holland, Yugoslavia, Greece, Turkey, and thereabouts. My own family on my father's side left Toledo for Smyrna in Turkey. And on my mother's side, they went from Barcelona to Tetouan in Spanish Morocco and to Marrakesh. And they still bear names such as Barcelon and Marachi. It was the Jews of Russia and Poland who swarmed to the New World to escape the more recent pogroms of those lands. And yet later on, the German, Polish, Hungarian, and other Jews from Hitler's Nazi-occupied countries found refuge in America from the worst pogroms of their history. Refuge from unspeakable mass death in gas chambers or in execution pits. That is why European Jews predominate in America, and the Sephardic, Spanish, and Portuguese Jews are still only a small percentage in comparison. No one has ever embarked at New York port can fail to agree that it is among the most beautiful, largest, and best of all great ports of the world. It is claimed that New York Harbor could easily contain any 6 of the world's largest ports. Other than the burke barge canoes of the original Indian inhabitants, the small ship Half Moon, sailed by European Henry Hudson, was the first to travel in 1609 the majestic river that leads to Manhattan Island. The river bears the explorer's name, the Hudson, and so does one of New York's hotels, the Henry Hudson, where I was to attend the annual dog show at the American Afghan Hound Association. The parked English explorer Hudson was in the employ of the Dutch East India Company. It was the Dutch who first settled Manhattan and the surrounding areas, called their settlement New Amsterdam. Here is a legend, and it is true, that Peter Minuet, a governor of the Dutch Trading Company, purchased Manhattan Island from the wild men for $24 of baubles and a small amount of fancy cloth. In land value alone, it is worth untold millions of dollars only a few hundred years later, and the population has grown from a handful of Indians to millions of people who have come from all over the world to settle and trade there. I was coming to, quote, trade in my books. A number of American publishers had written to my English publishers, Faber and Faber, concerning their interest in a book that I had written about Galilee of the Holy Land, Legends and True Travel Trails, Summer in Galilee. And so the modern title of the book is called Summer in Galilee, now published by Ash Tree Publishing. With the help of a New York literary agent, Paul Reynolds, American publication of that book and several of my earlier ones was envisaged. So now I, too, had come to the Golden Door, rather old and tired and much traveled. Before I left Grenada in Spain, my gypsy friend, the great dancer La Farona, one of the gypsy priestesses of the famed mountain caves dancing places of Sacromonte, had taken my hand unasked, and had begun reading it. I had never seen her hand reading before, and she seemed in a trance. As she pressed her powerful dancer's leg against mine, she prophesied great success in America. I was not to find it. Moderate success in my work, but the making of many American friends and friendships that I know will endure my life through. Success may come later. Verona had seemed so sure, and indeed she is always questioning any friends of mine who had come from America to Spain, asking them, had I made my fortune? Farona is dead now. Her remarkable face is deeply etched on my mind, and I miss her. We will meet again, likely, in the spirit world of the dead. Some friendships are everlasting. Safely in through the Golden Door, past the customs officials, who I feared might seize my harmless herbs if they found them, perhaps believing them to be some form of the forbidden marijuana, and they had not at all liked the look of my luggage in the form of big travel battered baskets, I was able to gaze about me with quieter eyes at the New York scene, taking one's eyes away from the pleasing natural waters of the great river on which our ship still rode. I was pleased to see natural-looking rocks on one side of the harbor, and here and there clumps of trees or a solitary tree, leafless now in the month of December. All else around looked artificial, so much a show of man's cleverness that although as I came to know Manhattan well and the rest of New York a little, and to find much beauty after all, I was at that moment regretting the lack of American Indians in their peaceful setting among the wild roses and the bramble thickets. In England, those plants remain in leaf, green turning to gold well into January. Now leafless and stony gray, the inimical seeming world stretched around me, filled with a noise of moving vehicles that was incredible in its volume and diversity, and not pleasing at all. I know that it is claimed that New York City has more trees than buildings or people, and city officials are trying to keep it that way, but the great old elms of Washington Square and other places in the city are stricken with disease and falling. Can trees really live and flourish in poisoned, polluted air, drinking dirty water streaked with petrol from the teeming motor vehicles? The pear tree of New York's good and romantic first governor, Peter Stuyvesant, survived through nearly three centuries, but had to be cut down recently. Legend tells us that Stuyvesant used one of his pear tree bows for a new peg leg when he had worn down the first one through his habit of stamping with it upon the ground to emphasize his orders. I'm going to read that again. The pear tree of New York's good and romantic first governor, Peter Stuyvesant, survived through nearly three centuries, but had to be cut down recently. Legend tells us that Stuyvesant used one of his pear tree boughs for a new peg leg when he had worn down the first one through his habit of stamping with it upon the ground to emphasize his orders. I regret it that I was not to see what must have been New York's most famous tree, and a pear tree, even an ordinary, non-famous one, is always a lovely thing in its blossom time. That must have looked good, the white fleeces of pear blossom, wind-tossed against the surrounding monotony gray of city buildings. And apple blossoms also, rose-tinted on the white. Those sweet tree blossoms are truly a refreshment to the nostrils and the soul. New York State has fame for its apple orchards, some of which are truly vast. But those apple orchards have not given New York its strange and endearing name, the Big Apple. An American schoolgirl, Emma Palmer, had the intelligence to make use of the New York Free Information Service, which will answer questions concerning New York, so we can learn about the Big Apple. It is associated with jazz players who call a job an apple. A gig or a job in New York is a Big Apple. Later, New York itself came to be called the Big Apple. There are porcelain cups for sale in New York, shops with the big red apple on them, and two words, New York. Yet surprisingly, few people know how the apple and New York came to be associated. Merely ask your New York friends to confirm this. Whenever I hear about unusual events in world weather patterns, losses of forest and other strange phenomena afflicting the world, such as the reports that famed ancient monuments like the pyramids of Egypt and the Acropolis of Greece are crumbling, I'm always possessed by worrying thoughts as to the far-reaching and yet incalculable effects of atomic bomb test explosions. More than the scientists, the simple peasants of the world greatly fear them. I was surprised when I first learned that the peasants interest themselves in the atomic explosions, but they certainly do. And the gypsies of the world, who are still greatly gifted with the powers of prophecy, warn frequently against the experiments, which they say bring with them a charnel smell to the earth and its waters. I have been told about Jacob Joshua Levison, chief forester for the city of New York, who, as a boy, had come from Latvia to the slums of Manhattan's Lower East Side. Wanting the trees that he must have known in his early childhood in Latvia, he became one of the greatest crusaders for conservation of America's trees and forests. He was associated with places where trees survive, the cloisters and the gardens of the Metropolitan Museum of Tudor City, which saved New York from becoming an ugly city. It was this tree and plant-loving man who created one of the largest and most original of the roof gardens of Manhattan, covering almost 2 acres and remarkably being only 6 feet above the level of the street and built over a garage roof of a 300-car capacity. This man said that it was the sordidness of a treeless existence that caused me to choose forestry over other vocations. Then as now, the aesthetic aspects of trees appealed to me as much as the practical ones. As soon as my children got out into New York streets and noticed the iron and wooden railings around the trees and no climbing notices by many of the surviving rocks in the public parks, "What are we to climb?" they asked me in dismay. "No trees, no rocks." "You'll find plenty of climbing in New York buildings," I assured them. "No need to use elevators. We have legs to carry us up and down, as you know." Then sun came out above the towering rooftops of Manhattan. The harbor sky was no longer ashen. Daffodil streaks appeared there, and golden sun rays like the tall yellow candles I have seen the Baltic gypsies carrying to the shrine of the world's only gypsy saint, the Black Virgin, Saint Sarah, who has domain over her underground chapel beneath the ancient church of Les Saintes Maries de la Mer in the French Camargue province. The sun, I don't know what, why, boy, that was quite a detour. All right, let me get back to reading. The sun over New York. When later I came to know artists in New York, they told me that in wintertime, nowhere in Europe, not even in southern Spain, famous for its light, is there to be found more sun and light than along the open places of New York by its waterfront and its parks. But all the time I was in New York, the sun was associated with one of my greatest frustrations, for there is nowhere to sunbathe. Every grimy rooftop, every patch of parkland seemed overlooked. I am, with all my being, a sun and fire worshiper, and I do not mean the artificial fire or light from electric sun lamps or fire stoves or gas fires. I mean the powerful, naked sun and the flames from true gypsy fires of piled wood or turf, or next best, from rich chunks of coal. When one sunbathes and fire bathes, one never feels cold. In the bitterest of New York sub-zero weather, I was always warm. I never once wore a top coat, because immediately before coming to America, I had been fed for 3 years by the sun of Spanish Andalusia, and later of Mexico, living always in primitive places where it was possible to sunbathe completely. Whenever the sun was shining, I envied the New York pigeons, sun seekers, like all the family of the doves. They flitted from sunlit ledge to sunlit ledge of the New York buildings, and the golden light gilded their plumage, which has the colors and the shimmer of its iris flowers. In Washington Square, I found the pigeons more at home, as if in their original woodland setting. So there in the square, they had found tree hollows for nesting places. And on sunny mornings, even in the winter months, they made their soothing pigeon sounds, which were a strange but pleasing addition to the surrounding noises of Manhattan. The modern steam heating of New York, Chicago, and other towns in North America that experience cold winters is considered an essential of civilized life. Yet most foreign visitors to New York complain about the stifling heat of New York apartments, stores, and restaurants. I was never able to accept, enjoy, or understand that unbearable airless heating. It seemed to me to be the best formula for catching a true New York feverish cold, from which most of my friends were suffering at one time or another, whenever I was in that city. To go out from such a natural heat to the cold of often 10 degrees below zero in the streets. Those overhot New York buildings made me often feel that I was being slowly steamed alive like a crab in this horrible recipe, which a beer firm was advertising under the headline, "From Chesapeake Bay, Land of Pleasant Living." So, here is a steamed crab recipe. Use a steam pot that has an elevated platform. For every dozen crabs used, put into the steamer 1 cup of beer, 1 cup of vinegar, and enough water to cover. Place live soft crabs that have just shed their shells on platform in layers. Sprinkle seasoning, salt, pepper, mustard, paprika, cayenne between the layers of crabs. Steam, do not boil, for about 20 minutes until the crabs are fiery red and ready to eat. Back to shameful. However, despite the present-day world being meaner and crueler to animals than ever before, many crabs and lobsters are now first stabbed through the back before being steamed. As the slow steaming alive were not agony enough, the additional sprinkling of burning spices pricks the eyes and other parts of the live creatures piled upon one another. and crabs are wise and clever. I came to know very well the land crabs of tropical Mexico and the sweetwater crabs of the Sea of Galilee. No wonder that I bring up my two children to be vegetarians and hope they will stay that way. I read out that the crab recipe to them as a reminder. The gypsies are some of the New York winter visitors who complain most about the steam heating and are nostalgic for their big outdoor fires. Like migratory birds, hundreds, perhaps thousands of gypsies enter New York for the winter season, congregating especially in and around Manhattan and Brooklyn. They come for the profitable fortune-telling earnings of their women and the odd metal repairing piecework and cloth trading dealing of their men. Many of the gypsy lads work profitably as bootblacks. They come also in troops as dancers and singers, and the Hungarians among them provide violin music in restaurants and cafes. Many of them have been living outdoors in desert parts of California or in North America's numerous forests. For even the American gypsy, the most civilized of their race, remains nomad at heart. Now they come to stifle in the city. The American gypsy mostly truck travels today, although many of the fortune-telling families use expensive Cadillac cars and well-equipped trailers when on the road. Indeed, Cadillacs are the most typical of the many cars that the American gypsies drive. Countless New York gypsies have commiserated with me concerning the unpleasantness of life in steam-heated apartments. They stifle in the overheating, but when windows are opened and the street dirt blows in upon them, if they turn off all the heating, they freeze with the damp cold of the shut-in house places where the sunlight never enters. Gypsies in New York nearly always rent ground floor rooms because not only do they like to see the road, their beloved drum around them, but it is also better for business. However, today many gypsies have to be satisfied with first floor apartments. There they will still close enough to their drum for life to be bearable. One seldom finds gypsies living higher up than the first floor. And the gypsies of New York, where are they? One of the first thoughts that occupy my mind when entering any new city is, will there be gypsies? And where will I find them? One is told, ask the police. They always keep track of the gypsies. But do they keep track? I think they are unable to do so, for it is rightly said of New York gypsies that no one knows how many there are in the city because they are nomads. They move from borough to borough and neighborhood to neighborhood. And when they are not traveling farther afield from city to city or from state to state, and more persistently than any other race, the gypsies keep two or more names. Constant enmity with soldiers and police has driven them to do this. So the gypsies have two names, a Romany family name and a, quote, civilized one, in keeping with the land in which they settle or travel most. The second name they use for school, business, and police. School was in quotes, if their children ever attend one, and business and police. The gypsies themselves have told me that their population in New York is a shifting one of around 3,000 in the winter time, but far less in the spring and summer. They reckon that in Los Angeles, there were about 7,000 strong. I get to know the gypsies of every town that I visit because I am sure of finding among them loyal friendship and interesting companionship and true amusement, song, music, dance, magic, all of these and more, love sometimes. In any Spanish or Turkish or Balkan town, one is almost sure to find a gypsy quarter. Also, in many French towns. But New York has no gypsy quarter nowadays, although I believe there was one once. I had no intention of asking the police to help me to find my friends. The only American guidebook that I ever saw which mentioned the gypsies said there was a gypsy quarter in New York in the neighborhood of the Essex Street Market. The book went on to say that around Broome Street, close by the market, there many dark complexion people living in the ground floor places, such as long abandoned warehouses or tenting out in backyards. These families are especially numerous along Attorney Street, where almost every ground floor room is occupied by them, as their doors are nearly always open to look inside and see the strangely foreign dwelling places of hanging curtains dividing the rooms into smaller portions, where family lived along with other families. Mattress beds or rag litter floors, very little furniture, and charcoal brazier fires in the winter. And above all, flocks of dark-faced children with flashing smiles and teeth of pearl. The only begging children in that poor class neighborhood who dart out from almost every other home pleading, "Give me a nickel, kind lady, kind gentleman, give me a dime." These are the proofs. These are the gypsies, the guidebook said. We have about a minute left. Let me see how much more we can get to. I'm on page 19 and it goes to 23. So, and the book description is true enough of the care house gypsies of New York. For no matter how prosperous the fortune-telling gypsies are, they nearly are always choose to sleep behind their place or in their place after the clients have gone away. They prefer bedrolls on the floor, thin mattress-type things, which they will then roll up and store away during the daytime. And the same house living plan. That's very informative. Okay, the same house living plan applies also to the other American gypsies, whether they are fortune tellers or not. Some even erect tents inside the stores and burn wood chips inside old tins. And that way, fire worship as usual, although to be a very limited extent. I went to the Essex Street neighborhood in search of the gypsies soon after my arrival in New York. But although I found there people from almost all lands, including many of the old-fashioned Yiddish-speaking types of black-clad European Jews and many Puerto Ricans in gaudy clothes, there were no gypsies to be seen. I patiently searched every street in the neighborhood and made inquiries in many shops. That way, from the shopkeepers, I did find that gypsies had lived there once, but only recently, as a year ago. Their places had all been condemned and the tenements had been pulled down. Now, big new apartment houses stood ready completed where the gypsy tents had once been in open yards. And more big modern buildings were being erected. Indeed, that typical noise of New York building construction could be heard on all sides, that hammering of steel girders, the whirring of the concrete mixers, one Jewish concrete mixers, and the knock of bricks falling or being laid into place. One Jewish grocer said he did remember the gypsy families of Attorney Street. Nice people, very handsome. They seemed to live mostly on bread and bars of chocolate, did not use electric lights, liked to burn candles. So with that, I picked a song from REO Speedwagon to close the show, and look forward to doing the show again next week, next month, on the first Thursday of the month. So join me again. And it was nice spending this time with you.
When it's time to begin.